Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. President Trump is cleared in the two-year investigation into collusion with Russia.
This was a phony story from the get-go in search of facts to try and support it.
Some on the left refuse to go quietly.
The people who wanted to protect the investigation now are among the first to disparage it and try to question the conclusion.
We'll look at the winners.
This will shape and sharpen the president's argument for re-election, and it will fuel his war against the media.
And the losers.
A journalist has to investigate the veracity of a story before they air it.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com. And let me invite you to follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. 2 years, costing over $25 million, 19 lawyers involved, 40 FBI agents and other professionals, 2,800 subpoenas, 500 search warrants, 500 witnesses interviewed. At the end of the day, after all of that, special counsel Robert Mueller concluded, there's nothing here. No collusion. And Attorney General Barr concluded, no obstruction of justice. You can all go home now. In an instant, President Donald Trump was handed a critical and a decisive victory over Democrats and the media who had hounded him relentlessly his entire presidency. Impeachment talks were predicated on the incessant claim that he had colluded with Russia or that he had obstructed justice. Many on the 2020 campaign trail used that narrative to gain voters and entice donors. Now the grip Democrats believe they had on Trump has slipped away like a fish in a murky lake. It's gone. Just a few days after the monumental announcement, United States Senator John Cornyn joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
How do you react to the Barr letter and its summary of the Mueller report?
Well, I think it's really says what I think we knew pretty much all along. Prominent Democrats like Senator Feinstein and Senator Warner had said there was no evidence of collusion. And so it's really no surprise hearing from Mr. Mueller that I guess the surprise is the people who wanted to protect the investigation now are among the first to disparage it and try to question the conclusion. So this is not about a search for the truth. This is about politics. It's pretty clear.
Now, I just had Senator Cotton on, and let me play for you the exchange, which was very bracing, and get your reaction to it, Adam. Do you think they tried to sabotage the transition?
I do, Hugh. I think that they rushed down an ill-considered document, again, built on a fake dossier that is actually the only source of collusion with foreign intelligence, namely Christopher Steele, a discredited former British intelligence officer who no doubt built most of the allegations in that dossier based on, yes, Russian intelligence services.
So senior Obama administration officials attempted to sabotage the transition. That's your working premise?
I don't think, based on what we've seen over the last 3 years, you can have any other working premise.
I agree.
And I think further inquiry will reveal exactly who they are. Some of them are well-known, some of them are not well-known, but further inquiry is needed.
So, Senator John Cornyn, how do you react to that?
Well, I agree with what Senator Cotton and you said. The problem was this does not just stop at the mid-level management at the FBI. This has to go all the way to the top. I can't believe, especially when President Obama was talking about Hillary's email investigation and how she did not have the requisite intent to commit an offense, that wasn't telegraphed to the leadership at the DOJ and the FBI that they better leave her alone. And they expected her to be the next president of the United States. When that didn't turn out, they were more than happy to pursue this search and destroy mission, starting with Director Comey, who testified in open session before the Intelligence Committee that he's the one who sent a memo of his conversations with the president to his law professor buddy and asked him to release it to the press so that a special counsel would be appointed. This is really ugly looking, and it really talk about interference with our elections and the mandate of the voters. This is it.
Well, I go back to Strzok and Page and then the unmasking of sources during the transition, and Senator Cotton and I were focusing specifically on what happened during the transition. I don't know if our IC was involved in this beyond the senior level of the FBI, and I know the FBI is largely 95% unconnected to what happened here, and ditto the intelligence community. But do you suspect the false flag was run against the Trump campaign during the transition?
Well, I think Director Brennan certainly hadn't covered himself in glory in all this. He seems like he was been on a search and destroy mission from day one, and unduly partisan, and that continues until now. I think they were surprised, like everybody was, that the president won. While the counterintelligence investigation might have been warranted based on some peripheral activities by some of these hangers-on in the campaign, it's pretty clear to me that the president himself was never told that the Russians were shaking the door handle and the windows and trying to get into the campaign, and given the a defensive briefing that Loretta Lynch said was routine. And so he could tell these folks to knock it off or disassociate them with his campaign.
Now, the chairman of one of the committees you sit on, Judiciary, Lindsey Graham, wants a second special counsel to investigate. Do you agree with him on that?
I need to talk to Senator Graham about that. I don't know why General Barr would be conflicted out. We know what happened to General Sessions because of his specific activity in the political campaign, which was the subject of the investigation. It's not obvious to me why General Barr would be conflicted out and why he couldn't do the job.
Well, I think what I have in mind and what maybe Senator Graham has in mind is that Barr isn't conflicted, and the AG would simply say, I'm taking it from Huber, where it's been out in Utah. No one's known anyone's been going on. I'm giving it to the guy down the hallway. I'm on the fifth floor of the DOJ. Here's his name or her name. Mm-hmm. And they're going to get me a report on whether or not we have to bring charges against anyone for FISA abuse within 3 weeks. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't think there's a lot that isn't known about this, Senator Cornyn. Do you agree with me?
What you find out is, even though there's a lot of classified information that's reviewed by members of Congress, that in the end, there are not many secrets here in Washington, D.C. So I agree that there's really not a lot of mystery involved here. I think we see the parameters of what was at work here. Maybe it didn't start out as a search and destroy mission against President Trump, but that sure ended up this way. And that Director Comey would take a conscious decision to leak information in order to force Rod Rosenstein to appoint special counsel and end up here almost 2 years later is really a national scandal.
Professor John Eastman of Chapman University believes there is a Russia story here, but it doesn't involve President Trump. He spoke with Salem host Larry Elder.
Professor, no further indictments, no evidence of obstruction, at least no finding of obstruction, no finding of collusion, no finding of conspiracy, no finding of coordination, no allegation that the DOJ in any way interfered with the Mueller report.
Well, that's right. But I do want to say this. We do have a lot of evidence of collusion, but on the other side of the political aisle, the Clinton Foundation receiving millions and millions of dollars from Russian sources for Hillary to sell out our uranium reserves. The funneling of money illegally through a law firm, campaign expenditures, to pay for a dossier that was rooted on third-hand knowledge from a Russian agent. There was collusion with Russia, but it was Hillary and Obama. It was not President Trump. The mm-hmm. Mueller report completely vindicates President Trump. But look, we've all known that for a long time. This was a phony story from the get-go in search of facts to try and support it, and after 2.5 years, they weren't able to come up with anything. Not a surprise, because it wasn't based on reality in the first place.
Professor Eastman, I don't understand why the special counsel said, quote, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it does not exonerate him, close quote. It's not his job to exonerate him.
Well, I know. And what he's trying to do is play both sides of the political aisle in this report or in the summary of the report that we thus far have from Attorney General Barr.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know exactly what Mueller says in the report. We have the summary from Barr. But, you know, look, I mean, he's trying it a bit, I think, to protect some of his friends, you know, most notably Mr. Comey, who were in this thing up to their eyeballs in scandal. I mean, we have funneling of Russian money to Secretary of State to sell out our uranium. We have campaign violations. We have the outgoing administration conducting a spying operation on the political opponent's presidential campaign for the incoming administration. This is beyond what Richard Nixon tried to do. They actually succeeded in doing it, and nobody's talking about that. And I think the whole Mueller story and Russia collusion was designed to kind of get our eyes off the ball of what really went on here, which is, you know, on a Watergate scale.
What about all the colluding that Hillary, the campaign, did with the Ukrainians and all the things you've outlined? Is the DOJ going to do anything about that?
Well, you know, there's some intimation that they're going to, and the calls for full disclosure that you're seeing now, not just on the Mueller report, But Lindsey Graham's calls for a broader disclosure of the FISA warrants that led to the Obama administration spying on the Trump campaign during the presidential election. That's what we really need with disclosure on, because this is stunning that this occurred in America. This is kind of the banana republic type stuff, and yet it was done at the highest echelons of the Obama administration.
Professor, 19 lawyers, a team of 40 FBI agents, intelligence analysts, forensic accountants, and other professional staff, 2,800 subpoenas, 500 search warrants, 230 orders from communication records, 13 requests to foreign governments for evidence, interviewed 500 witnesses. What are all these continuing investigations by the House going to uncover that the Mueller investigation did not?
Well, what they're going to try and do is find little snippets that are ambiguous so they can put a different spin on it and try and salvage some sense of propriety for the last 2 years of wasted effort. Mueller should have never been appointed in the first place. There was no evidence of a crime. And under FBI and Department of Justice guidelines and regulations, there was absolutely no basis for appointing a special prosecutor in the first place. Rod Rosenstein went beyond his legal authority to do that. But then once it had been done, everybody's saying, well, you can't get rid of it. Everybody will claim collusion and then claim obstruction of justice and all that. So we had to let it run its course. But it was a monumental waste of time and effort. And more importantly, and this is the real sad note here, the Russians, to the extent they tried to interfere with the election, it wasn't to put the thumb on the scale for Hillary or Donald Trump. It was to rip the country apart no matter how the election came out. And all they've done with this Mueller report is, you know, play the patsy for what Putin wanted to accomplish in the first place.
Professor, what do you suppose Jeff Sessions is thinking right now?
I think Jeff Sessions is regretting that he initially agreed to recuse himself from this whole operation.
Mm-hmm.
There was a carryover ethics officer in the Inspector General's office at the Department of Justice that told him he needed to recuse himself. And if he doesn't recuse himself at that point, then the people will be howling that he's, you know, breaking ethical rules. That carryover person ought not to have given that advice because it was erroneous. There was nothing that he said or did that should have warranted recusal. But having taken that step to go back on it would lead to all sorts of other political complications. So I think he was in a box,
mm-hmm.
a box that was of the making of an Obama administration holdover. This kind of refusal to recognize the results of the 2016 election and to facilitate the transition and to actually do the job for the new boss in town, as career civil servants are supposed to do, that didn't happen this time. It's only the second or third time in our history that we've had such an absolute obstruction in the transition to a new administration.
Go to townhallreview.com for the entire discussion with Eastman.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Coming up,
this will shape and sharpen the president's argument for re-election, and it will fuel his war against the media.
The winners and losers when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you by the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. While some Democratic politicians pinned their 2020 presidential campaign hopes on a Mueller report that was damaging to the president, many in the media based their careers on the same. Some rose to fame with nightly reports that, in hindsight, are nothing more than conspiracy theory programs that have now been publicly and finally debunked. Media reputations are on the line, and so far, the institution as a whole has not handled the latest news well. There are some notable exceptions, but too few in an industry dependent upon credibility are stepping forward to say, my bad. Mike Allen, co-founder and executive editor of Axios, is one of the first to admit that Trump won the day. Mike, join me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. This is a big win for Donald Trump.
No question. There's a lot of unanswered questions for this, but the president came out after this, said he felt vindication, and I just asked people to think about how they would have considered how they would have covered this if it had come out the opposite way. So the headline of Axios AM, Trump claims vindication, eyes, vengeance, now a reckoning. So this will shape and sharpen the president's argument for re-election, and it will fuel his war against the media.
Now, what's interesting is perilous territory for the media, Mike Allen, because for the last 2 years, it has been a legitimate story to raise questions of collusion and obstruction. I didn't believe it. I've always said, let Mueller finish his work. Don't interfere. Do not impede. And good that he did. However, it is now not a legitimate story to say maybe there was collusion, maybe there was obstruction. It has been decisively, completely repudiated. I think we're going to need a chalkboard in every newsroom where reporters, producers, and broadcasters can write 1,000 times. No collusion, no obstruction. But if others persist in trying to make this a story, do they not threaten the viability of their platforms?
Well, what's very interesting is the resistance to the resistance. What we saw on Twitter was a number of liberals who were praising each other for their skepticism about this Glenn Greenwald and others. Most notably, Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone. He said that this for sure had hurt the media. He calls Russiagate the new WMD.
Paul Fahey at The Washington Post, I want your reaction to this, writes this morning, Barr's announcement was a thunderclap to mainstream news outlets and the cadre of mostly liberal-leaning commentators who have spent months emphasizing the possible collusion narrative in opinion columns and cable TV panel discussions. I do believe it's a thunderclap. I just don't know that those who've been repeating it for so long are going to be able to wake up, Mike. Do you think they can wake up to the post-Mueller world?
Well, I think what we're going to see in the post-Mueller world is we're going to see House Democrats continuing to pursue their investigations. We say on Axios AM that because Mueller, according to the summary from Bill Barr, and it's important to pause and remind your listeners that we haven't seen the Mueller report. What we've seen is Bill Barr's summary of the Mueller report. There's a lot of questions about legal theory and evidence that will still be uncovered. But Democrats are going to start by pushing for that full report, the underlying evidence for it. And we're going to see some of them because Mueller, according to this summary, had sort of a hung jury, a split decision, that a failure to reach a conclusion on obstruction of justice. We think a lot of Democrats will start to pursue that. So we have a headline on Axios saying that the new Russia could be obstruction.
Now, what's interesting to me is that it actually isn't a hung jury, but this goes to the law, and I think a lot of people are going to get this wrong. What he said is there is no obstruction under any ordinary reading of any ordinary statute, but I defer to the attorney general if he wishes to find a different reading. That's not a hung jury. They didn't find obstruction. And so, to me, this is where the non-lawyers get into trouble, is trying to read this. I want to go back, though, to the actual letter. I've got Barr's letter here.
And what about the phrase where it says the Mueller report does not conclude that the president committed a crime? These are Mueller's words.
Yeah,
by Barr.
Barr's words.
They don't conclude that the president committed a crime. It also does not exonerate him.
I think that's a great line.
Those are the words of Mueller.
I'm quoting, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. I can say that about everyone in Washington, D.C. on every day. I can say that when anyone's alleged to have done anything wrong, I can say they have not been charged, but they haven't been exonerated. I can say that about Benghazi. I can say that about Watergate. I can say that about every single crime where someone didn't go to jail. You can say that. So it's like saying there's a dog barking out there somewhere. I really think, Mike, the media has got to come to grips or they're going to be shattered. No one's going to believe anything they say if they hang on to that. While there are a few in the media who admit this entire affair was poorly handled, many others have been reluctant to do so. Here's Salem syndicated talker Mike Gallagher.
And listen, when you've got the New York Times going to CNN and saying, you have anything to say for yourself, that's a good day. That's progress. And Jeff Zucker's answer, while he defended his network's coverage of the Russia investigation, Zucker said, we're entirely comfortable with our reporting, but we are not investigators. We are journalists, and our role is to report the facts as we know them, which is exactly what we did. Are you kidding me? Now, I get that the second part of that is cringe-inducing. Go to the first part. We're not investigators, we're journalists. Well, wait a minute. If you don't investigate a story, you put anything out there? Because it, what, supports your narrative that Trump is evil and must be stopped? You're not investigators. I'd be a little intrigued to hear what people who, like, study journalism or teach journalism would have to say about that assessment. Listen, I may not know much, but I always believed that a journalist has to investigate the veracity of a story before they air it. Or else anybody could be destroyed by a horrific false presentation on a network like CNN. I think they're done. I really do. I think some of these folks are finished. Rudy Giuliani went toe-to-toe with Chris Cuomo on CNN. Listen to Cuomo's defiant response to what Mayor Giuliani said about an apology.
You had a panel.
You guys
yes.
on this network,
what have I done?
Have tortured this man for 2 years with collusion, and nobody's apologized.
First of all, there,
so before we talk about obstruction,
there was
apologize for the overreaction of collusion.
Not a chance.
Well, of course you're not.
Not a chance.
Of course
you're
not, because you're not being fair.
No, please. You know better than that, or you wouldn't.
No, I don't know better. I am outraged by the behavior of these networks.
Okay.
Collusion. No collusion.
Okay. Here's my case.
No collusion.
Here's my case.
Apologize.
Never. Here's my case.
Never.
Never. I didn't do anything wrong. These questions are real.
Well, I
they needed to be regarded as such,
treasonous?
And they needed to be investigated. Did
people
you hear me say
on,
that?
No, but I heard.
Do I hold you to account for what people say that you don't?
There were people on this network that did. How about this network should apologize? How about Jeff Zucker? Should
do I ask you to apologize for everything the president says that's not true?
No.
Okay. Good. So we're even.
But you asked me to apologize for what I do, and I do. If I accuse
tell me what
somebody,
I did, and I'll apologize.
I'm not saying you should do it.
But then why
I'm
should I
your
apologize?
Your network should apologize.
I don't apologize for the
your
network.
Your network should apologize.
I'm proud of the
and
network.
NBC
I'm proud of the job
apologize.
It does, but
and
I only control what I say.
And the New York Times should apologize.
All right, hold on.
And the Washington Post should apologize.
Hold on. I'm not a media critic.
And Adam Schiff should apologize.
Look, that's a question for him. I'm happy to ask it.
Yeah, I'll bet you are happy to ask it. Did you hear what Cuomo said? Never. Never. Not a chance would I apologize for my nightly assertion that the president of the United States is a traitor. Not a chance. I'm proud of my network. You're proud of that? Wow.
I want to talk to you for a moment about a group I've done work with for years, ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. You've seen how your freedom is under attack, but if you act now, you can protect your family today and generations to come. Go to townhallreview.com to find out how you can join Alliance Defending Freedom to help ensure the opponents of freedom don't dictate your future. That's townhallreview.com.
Coming up,
Israel must keep its eye on the strategic ball. And the strategic ball is Iran, Iran, Iran.
Serious trouble in the Middle East when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Last weekend, several rockets struck Israel. One smashed into a residential home, injuring 7 people. On the surface, it was Hamas, up to their usual terror, targeting civilians even in a time of relative peace. But there's more to the story. I invited Michael Oren on the Hugh Hewitt Show to explain. Oren is a former Israeli ambassador to the United States, current member of the Israeli Knesset, deputy prime minister of Israel.
Dr. Oren, you're on the job, and it looks like you're on the brink of war over there. What is the situation in Israel today?
An uneasy quiet right now after a night of shooting in Gaza. And yesterday morning, about 5 a.m., when we in central Israel were awakened by air raid sirens, a rocket fired by Hamas struck a home in central Israel, wounded several members of one family, interestingly enough, a British Israeli family. Fortunately, no one was killed, but that was the longest missile fire since the 2014 war and shook up the country and created a situation where the prime minister, who was in Washington, D.C., getting ready to meet with the president in an historic gesture of American recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, had to quickly sign that document and get on a plane and come home.
When you're on the brink of war, you've got to get back. Now, the question is, after a night of unrelenting airstrikes, has Hamas decided enough is enough, no mas, or are they, in fact, preparing to do, they want a war, according to one story in the Jerusalem Post this morning, to divert attention from their domestic problems in Gaza? Is that true?
I don't think they want a war. They simply want tension, and they want shooting to divert attention. They've had major demonstrations against Hamas misrule and corruption. There's 50% unemployment in Gaza. There's no electricity. There's no clean water. People are beginning to place the blame where it belongs, squarely on the shoulders of Hamas. And Hamas has suppressed those demonstrations quite violently. But whether Hamas wants a full-scale war is another question. They sense a weakness in Israel right now because we're at the height of our election season. We're about 2 weeks off from election. No one wants a war here either, certainly given this situation. And they feel that that Hamas felt that they could fire this rocket into central Israel and ramp up the pressure on Israel to give in to some of Hamas's demands, which are principally that Israel lifts the maritime blockade that Israel maintains around the Gaza Strip to prevent Hamas from importing weapons, but that also costs Hamas economically as well.
And so there's not going to be a negotiated settlement with Hamas or anything really with Hamas ever. The question is, does this have an impact on the election?
It does indeed. And the prime minister was under attack unusually both from the left and the right for not doing enough to rid Gaza of Hamas. The prime minister and the Israeli government has acted with the utmost responsibility in not getting into a war in Gaza. Because who wants that war? Iran wants the war. It wants the war to detract attention from its attempts to establish itself militarily in Syria. It's willing to fight Israel to the last Palestinian. It doesn't care how many civilians get killed in that war. Abu Mazen, the president of the Palestinian Authority, he wants war. He hates Hamas. He's willing to fight Hamas to the last Israeli soldier and then to sue us for war crimes in the International Criminal Court after that. So he wins twice. Everyone wants the war, and it doesn't serve Israel's interest. Israel must keep its eye on the strategic ball, Hugh, and the strategic ball is Iran, 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 and do not get bogged down in a debilitating war of attrition in Gaza, because that's just what our enemies want.
Well, that is the classic two-front dilemma. Your real front, it faces north, right? And that is why the significance of the Golan Heights annexation recognition is so immense. Would you mind explaining why is what President Trump did of any consequence whatsoever to Israel when he recognized that Israel had indeed legally and finally annexed the Golan Heights, and it will always be a part of Israel?
Well, first of all, there's a moral quantity to it that has been largely overlooked. The moral quantity is that Golan Heights has now been in the hands of Israel almost three times longer than it was in Syria's hands. Syria didn't develop the area. It used it twice as a launching ground for a war of national destruction against us. It's a traditional part of the land of Israel, if you look in the Bible. They're a part of Syria. So there's a moral quality, there's a historical quantity to it. But strategically speaking, Israel's presence on the Golan Heights is essential for preventing Iran and Iran proxies like Hezbollah from descending southward, not only into Israel, but into Jordan, and from Jordan into Saudi Arabia and the entire Gulf region. Israel's presence on the Golan Heights is essential for the stability and security of the entire Middle East, which is why, while the Europeans and the people in America were condemning President Trump for signing this recognition, the Arabs were completely silent, Hugh, because they know.
Is there any difference, because the West Bank was also in a war of defensive war in 1967, Israel assumed control of the West Bank. Is there any difference of the argument vis-a-vis the Golan Heights and the right to the Golan Heights than there is to the West Bank?
One major difference. On the Golan Heights, there is not a single Palestinian. And so the notion of territory for peace is established in Resolution 242 of the UN doesn't really apply to the Golan Heights, because there's no one to give the Golan Heights back to for peace. We're supposed to give it back to Bashar al-Assad.
Yeah.
They're supposed to give it back to ISIS. You're not going to get peace.
Okay, so
there have been many chances. And the West Bank has millions of Palestinians in it. Those will claim that those Palestinians deserve the right to self-determination. That argument is completely irrelevant when applied to the Golan Heights.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, an abortion doctor turns pro-life.
And when I became a doctor, I couldn't understand how the German doctors did what they did until I looked at what I was doing, and I realized that I was no better than them.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. The movie Unplanned opens in 1,000 theaters this weekend. It's based upon the true story of a Planned Parenthood abortion nurse who walks away from the clinic and becomes a pro-life leader. Similarly, Dr. Kathy Altman, an abortion doctor, had a miraculous change of heart. She told her touching story to Ed Martin on 1380 The Answer in St. Louis, Missouri.
Our next guest is a doctor, board-certified OBGYN. She's a fellow at the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, and Dr. Kathy Altman practiced medicine for a long time with one view of what exactly it meant to, you know, think about life and when it started. And then flash forward to the last, well, a little while in her life, but in the last weeks and months, she's actually testified on behalf of those that are pushing heartbeat bills like what passed in Mississippi and Ohio and are being signed into law. Welcome to the program, Dr. Altman. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you? Thank you for having me on the show.
I'm doing great. I'm doing great. I know a lot of people are going to be fascinated. You know, people, the stories of folks who have changed their position, had their heart changed on this issue, on a lot of issues. So tell us a little bit about your life as a physician and what made you change your position on life and how to defend it.
Well, I used to be an abortionist. I used to do abortions, and I felt very strongly that abortion was a woman's right and that it had nothing to do with the baby. However, after I had my own child, I began to make the connection between baby and fetus. As a matter of fact, if the baby was unwanted, I called it a fetus. If the baby was wanted, I called it a baby. But after I had my own baby and made that connection, I felt that the baby being unwanted was no longer enough justification for me to kill it. The problem was that I still believed abortion was a woman's right, and I still referred for abortion. I just couldn't stomach doing them myself. And it really took seeing young women in my practice who kept their babies and did really, really well, versus those women that went ahead and had abortions and weren't doing so well, for me to begin to change my attitude. That didn't jive with the feminist rhetoric that I had embraced. And then also, as I saw children in my church grow up whose mothers considered, or at least could have considered, abortion, and I watched those children and realized that these were unique individuals who wouldn't be there had their mother made another choice. And that, again, began to eat away at my resolve. And then finally, when a friend gave me an article comparing abortion to the Holocaust, that's when it really struck me, because my dad was with the unit in World War II who entered, liberated the first concentration camp. And so I grew up with those pictures and stories. And when I became a doctor, I couldn't understand how the German doctors did what they did until I looked at what I was doing. And I realized that I was no better than them. And I could do what I was doing because I didn't see that fetus as a human being. It wasn't any different than a chick embryo that I dissected in college. And that's what finally made me turn to a pro-life view.
Well, and pardon my the bluntness of this question, but do you have a sense of how many abortions you would have been a participant in? I mean, did you ever do that tally? Or I hate to, it's sort of morbid, I know, but I bet it's a striking contrast to what you're doing today.
You know, I really don't know. I've blocked it out. It wasn't something that I wanted to remember. And I really don't have a number. I don't have any idea.
Hmm. Okay. Well, and so what, now you've sort of come along this path. Did you lose many clients? Did you lose much of your professional association? I mean, it's not exactly too common in the OBGYN community to be particularly too conservative on this. Was there much pushback and change in how your colleagues professionally treated you?
Actually, no, because this happened a long time ago. And in reality, although most OBGYNs are pressured into learning how to do abortions, most of them don't continue in their practice. And so out in private practice, there's a little bit more negative attitude towards you if you're doing abortions, at least in the South and in my community. None of my partners, and actually none of the people in our entire group, which was citywide, did abortion. So in that regard, no. But that's why a lot of abortionists a lot of people stop doing abortions is they don't want their pregnant patients to know that they were doing abortions. You know, pregnant patients aren't real happy about that.
Yeah. We're talking with Dr. Kathy Altman. Now, the heartbeat bill, which you've now testified for and is starting to pass in different places. Again, you've had this position now for years. You've articulated it. You've talked. Has the heartbeat bill particularly motivated you? Do you think it's a particularly helpful law, you know, in terms of the popular understanding? Is this a key moment? Tell me what your experience is in supporting the heartbeat bill.
Well, I think it's a good bill. I wish that we could, I wish we could stop all abortion, but I think the heartbeat gives a very good, definite place in development where once there's a heartbeat, around 95% of the time that pregnancy is going to continue. So it's a really good indicator of the viability of the pregnancy. And that is a better indicator than something like viability as used by the Supreme Court, because that's dependent on the technology available and people's willingness to treat. There are studies that have shown that if hospitals just give minimal care to these really early babies, that a lot of them survive. That's just maybe even just giving oxygen. And so where these real early babies are delivered makes a huge difference in whether they survive or not, because in many places, if they're 20 weeks, they do nothing.
Well, it's I should have said this at the beginning. One of the things you do is you're an associate scholar at the Lozier Institute, and up on the website, there's a lot of information on research and more information about you and your background. Thank you for your time and for standing up and for being willing to discuss this and your change and how important it is. It's really an important time for us to hear from voices like yours.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
There is no deal. The state dismissed the charges.
The shocking twist in the Jussie Smollett case when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. When the Chicago chief of police rattled off the offenses of Empire actor Jussie Smollett, it was clear he was angry. And so many were. Smollett embarrassed the city of Chicago and had much of the department chasing after a villain that did not exist. Eventually, Smollett was himself charged, and those charges were significant. And then on Tuesday, all charges were dropped. The police department was in shock. Even the liberal mayor, Rahm Emanuel, was incensed by the unusual action. Shortly after the announcement, Larry Elder gave this response.
All of the charges against Jussie Smollett have been dropped by the Illinois state attorney. Even though the Chicago PD, even though the mayor, both say that Jussie Smollett pulled a hoax. Even though the grand jury recommended 16 counts. But apparently, the charges have been dropped, and the state attorney has said that his bond will be forfeited, $10,000. His record will be sealed, no additional charges. They also say that the reason that they're dropping the charges is because of his history of doing community service, even though they did not specifically refer to what he's done in terms of community service. And the superintendent, Eddie Johnson, who held that press conference and outlined specifically the facts and the evidence, he was not given a heads up.
Prosecutors have their discretion, of course. We still have to work with the state's attorney's office. I'm sure we'll have some conversation after this. But again, at the end of the day, it's Mr. Smollett who committed this hoax, period. If he wanted to clear his name, the way to do that was in a court of law so that everyone could see the evidence. You all know what the bond prophet said. You know, we all know what it said. So, you know, I stand by the facts of what we produced. If they want to dispute those facts, then the place to do that is in court, not secrecy.
The Cook County State Attorney's Office put out this statement. After reviewing all of the facts and circumstances of this case, including Mr. Smollett's volunteer service in the community and agreement to forfeit his bond to the city of Chicago, we believe this outcome is a just disposition and appropriate resolution to this case. Close quote. Here's what the mayor of Chicago said.
But I remind everybody, it was not just the officer's work. That work, a piece of that work, was shown to a grand jury, and they made a decision based on only a sliver of the evidence. If I remember correctly, somebody wanted to have that evidence in the day, as the superintendent said, their day in court, so all the evidence could be made public. Because of the judge's decision, none of that evidence will ever be made public. None of it. This is without a doubt a whitewash of justice and sends a clear message that if you're in a position of influence and power, you'll get treated one way. Other people will be treated another way.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And take a moment to sign up for the podcast of our program. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Schubin and producer Charlie Richard, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.